Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Deborah England, Senior Program Officer of the Caret Foundation, and your chair for tonight's program, which is underwritten by the Caret Foundation as part of our series on the principles of a free society. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Alfred Regnery, publisher of The American Spectator and author of the new book, Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservativism. A Commonwealth Club audience will recognize that Al Regnery carries the name of the most preeminent conservative publishing house of the last 61 years. Indeed, Al has been a part of the conservative movement since he was a child, when his father first started Regnery Publishing in 1947. Having grown up in the movement, and having met many of the intellectual leaders of conservative thought around his family dinner table over the decades, he is uniquely situated to chronicle the development of the history, the principles, and the intellectual underpinnings of American conservatism since the middle of the 20th century. Al is an author, a publisher, and an attorney. On top of leading Regnery Publishing for 18 years, during which time he published 22 New York Times bestsellers, he has served as minority counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee and served in the Reagan Justice Department. In addition to his current leadership of the American Spectator, Al is chairman of the board for ISI, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and serves on numerous other boards of conservative organizations. Please welcome Alfred Regnery.
Thank you very much, Deborah. I'm certainly pleased to be at the Commonwealth Club this evening. When I was publishing books, this was a regular stop-off for many of our authors, so it's a treat to be here as an author instead of somebody who sent authors here. As Deborah mentioned, I recently published a book called Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservatism, and what I'm going to do this evening is go through, take a little part of that book and show you how three particular things that I talked about in the book that were introduced by intellectuals a long time ago actually made significant structural changes in American society. I want to talk to you about how a few good ideas changed the world, how a few libertarians, anti-communists, and traditional conservatives challenged the conventional wisdom, and how their ideas took hold and ultimately turned into a coherent political philosophy. Ultimately, those ideas were put to the test and, as you will see, made three serious structural and long-term changes in the way the world works. As World War II drew to a close, there were very few conservatives in America. The word conservative was rarely used, and most people had no idea what the word conservative meant. More surprising is the fact that the intellectual climate of the country was overwhelmingly left. Free markets, laissez-faire economics, low taxes, limited government, private property, and deregulation were rarely even mentioned. Communism, the epitome of leftism, was considered idealistic and benign. After all, the Soviet Union had been our ally, defeating Nazi Germany. The American Communist Party was commonly viewed as just another political party of sincere, if somewhat muddled, intellectuals. In a word, the United States was headed toward a controlled economy, toward massively large and intrusive government, and toward, in a word, socialism. Government, in the eyes of most Americans, dating back to the founders, was to be limited and unintrusive. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were based on the premise that government was the great threat to freedom, something that was ingrained in the American psyche until well into the New Deal. As H.L. Mencken said in 1926, it still remains, as it was in the beginning, the common enemy of all well-disposed, industrious, and decent men. It is the state. Starting during the administration of Woodrow Wilson, after he was elected in 1912, the federal government would be transformed from a small and nearly invisible entity to the behemoth that it would be just 30 years later. In 1945, when FDR died, World War II ground to a close, intellectual life in the United States was firmly liberal. To quote historian George Nash, the United States was, and I quote, a domestic superstate, a partially controlled economy with millions of conscripts under arms. There were still widespread fears of a reversion to depression once demobilization set in. Conservatism seemed moribund. There had been scattered opposition to the rise of the left before the war, but such opposition as existed hardly constituted a movement. Largely because of the Depression, which was still fresh in the minds of most people, few public figures advocated such things as free markets, private property, limited government, self-reliance, laissez-faire, or even anti-communism. And those who did were generally ostracized by the intelligentsia. Liberal dominance of the universities, the press, all the institutions of American life and culture went almost unchallenged. But not everybody agreed that the U.S. should become a left-leaning welfare state. Change was in the air. During the decade between 1945 and 1955, the intellectual foundation for the coming conservative movement was laid, and it was a foundation that would serve as a bedrock for an enduring movement. Ideas were its strength, and because people, both intellectuals and activists, were willing to stake their future on these ideas, conservatism withstood the heavy onslaught of the left. Its principal advocates were not concerned with ideas only as an intellectual exercise or to better understand the world they were living in. These men had practical ideas that challenged the status quo. They wanted to use their ideas to change the world. Although these conservatives did not think much of his theory of economics, they agreed with John Maynard Keynes, who said that, and I quote, "Ideas are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Sooner or later, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good and evil." Those intellectuals, and they were only a lonely few, lamented what had happened to the United States, and indeed to the rest of the world during the first half of the 20th century. They believed that cultural and political liberalism was at odds with American ideals at home and abroad, and believed that assaults on individual liberties, limited government, free markets, and Western culture ran counter to everything that the United States stood for. The first several of these intellectuals were classical liberals, or free market economists, led by Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises. Both were Austrian immigrants who left Europe just ahead of the Nazis, whose ideas of statism and economic control left no room for advocates of free markets. They were soon joined by Milton Friedman, George Stigler, and others. Hayek's little book, The Road to Serfdom, was published first in Britain and later in 1944 here in the United States. It taught that central planning and freedom were incompatible and that any entry onto the slippery slope of a planned centralized economy would lead to collectivization and tyranny, and that economic liberty was a prerequisite to political liberty. Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, which were operating under essentially the same rules, were examples of centralized economic planning which led to full-blown totalitarianism. Without the rule of law, said Hayek, no country could remain free. Since the late 1940s, free market economics has been studied and written about extensively, and now is a discipline with many followers and a full body of scholarship. There are fewer than 9 free market-oriented Nobel laureates in economics. The second group of intellectuals were anti-communists. Many had been members of the Communist Party or fellow travelers during the 1930s and knew firsthand what the Soviets wanted. FDR's depiction of communism as a benign democratic system, his referral to Stalin as Uncle Joe, was, they thought, naive and wrong. One of the most influential was a fellow named James Burnham, professor at NYU with degrees from Princeton and Oxford, former Trotskyite and a first-class intellect. Burnham argued that a third world war, the Cold War, had begun even before the end of World War II. Burnham challenged the conventional wisdom, originated by State Department official George Kennan, that the West should contain communism and restrict it to its borders, but not confront it militarily. The Soviet Union, Burnham believed, was bent on world conquest and was a threat to the values of the free world. Other intellectual anti-communists included Whitaker Chambers, Frank Meyer, Stefan Passoni, who was at Stanford, and Robert Conquest, and there were many others. The struggle between slavery and freedom, between communism and the West, was inescapably a struggle to the death. Communism, these former communists preached, was evil, would use every tactic available to it to subvert the West, both internally and externally. The U.S. should confront it, they believed, at every turn, at least short of actual invasion. The third group of intellectuals were known as traditionalists. led by Russell Kirk, Richard Weaver, and others. They were devoted to Western civilization, believed that religious piety was the foundation of civilization, and were troubled by the decline of culture, the leveling of discriminating standards, and the corruption of popular mores. Above all else, they had great faith in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the rule of law. They believed in limited government, checks and balances, and the separation of powers as a means of protecting the citizens from an intrusive government. They also believed that man was subservient to a supreme being in whose image man was created. Tradition, they believed, was necessary for the established order of civilization. The success of American conservatism is a story of how those ideas were transformed into a coherent political philosophy, how these ideas took hold in the body politic and became the foundation of a movement that is now one of the paramount political forces in contemporary American society. The story of how that happened is too long to recount today, but it is recounted, documented in my book, which I believe will be for sale for you after the event this evening, and which I will be glad to sign, by the way, before I leave. Conservatism was largely an intellectual movement until 1964, when Barry Goldwater was nominated to run for president. In the course of losing in one of the worst landslides in modern American political history, conservatives took over the Republican Party. They changed the way elections were financed. They established conservative ideas in the minds of millions of previously uncommitted citizens, started the construction of a network of conservative organizations, think tanks, donors, and political operatives, and introduced an amicable actor named Ronald Reagan to national politics. In the course of all of that, the conservative movement was no longer just an intellectual and academic enterprise, but it became a political force to be reckoned with. Although the liberal media decided that the Goldwater effort was misguided, stupid, and mindless, no longer was liberalism the dominant political philosophy. In fact, I submit to you that the Goldwater campaign launched the demise of liberalism as a national political force. 16 years later, with the election in 1980 and the subsequent re-election of Ronald Reagan in 1984, the movement moved from a political operation to one which proved that it could govern, one which could transform conservative ideas into successful policies, a true merger of intellectualism and politics. Political conservatism has certainly had its ups and downs since Reagan was elected, but in politics, ups and downs are a normal occurrence. But intellectually, the movement has continued to grow and to prosper, and has, in my opinion, a bright future. I'll come back to that at the end of my talk. But first, I want to talk about three specific long-term structural changes that have been brought about as a direct result of those conservative ideas I just touched upon, changes which represent the power of this movement we call conservatism. The first, the fall of Soviet communism and the end of the Cold War, fundamentally reordered world politics and, in the process, freed hundreds of millions of people. The idea of containment, supplemented by the concept of peaceful coexistence, was the foundation of U.S. foreign policy, beginning in the Truman administration and continuing until the early 1980s. Containment meant that the U.S. and its allies would confront the Soviets diplomatically, economically, and politically, but not militarily. There would be two coexisting superpowers, which would each maintain huge nuclear arsenals capable of destroying each other so that neither would presumably ever do so. According to the experts, the Soviet Union was just another legitimate country and a permanent member of the international community. But conservatives never liked containment, and starting with James Burnham in the 1940s, conservative anti-communists in book after book, speech after speech, and article after article challenged the notion that we could coexist with Soviet communism. Democratic and Republican administrations alike were challenged by conservative anti-communists, but to no avail. Containment continued to be at the heart of our foreign policy, at least until Ronald Reagan came along in 1981. One Reagan scholar has described Reagan's election as the culmination of the long history of American anti-communism, as Reagan had been an active anti-communist since his days in Hollywood. Reagan rejected the Nixon-Ford-Kissinger policy of detente with the Soviets and instead subscribed to the Burnham theory that in a war, including the Cold War, one side wins and one side loses. He agreed with conservative scholars that containment simply prolonged the process of winning by propping up the Soviet Union. Reagan believed that communism was evil and made it clear that he would do everything in his power to end the Cold War, not by invading the Soviet Union, but by doing what was necessary to see that it would collapse from within. U.S. foreign policy should be based on American ideals, democracy, and self-government, he announced. He would adopt a new foreign policy based on the fact that there was no longer any moral equivalence between the U.S. and the USSR. Concerning morals and values, the question was quite straightforward. We were right, and they were wrong. Reagan brought the best conservative and anti-communist foreign policy experts into his administration, mostly on the National Security Council, and they soon went to work to reverse old policies. Officially, that reversal came about when Reagan signed a new national security directive in early 1983, a highly classified document dedicating the Reagan administration to nothing short of reversing U.S. foreign policy so that its purpose was to bring about the end of Soviet communism and the launching of political pluralism in the old USSR. Said Richard Pipes, the Harvard professor of Russian history on leave to serve Reagan's NSC, the new policy is a clear break from the past. We said our goal was no longer to coexist with the Soviet Union. At its root was the belief that we had it in our power to alter the Soviet system through the use of external pressure. Said Secretary of State George Shultz, it was revolutionary. It turned on its head the doctrine of containment that had formed the cornerstone of American foreign policy since George Kennan sent his famous long telegram from Moscow in February 1946. Reagan followed shortly thereafter with the most famous and influential speech of his presidency, the so-called Evil Empire speech. The struggle against communism, he said, was not about weapon systems, bombs, and rockets, but it was a spiritual one. It was a test of moral faith, a struggle between good and evil. The Soviet Union was an evil empire. Nothing, Reagan said, could supplant victory against communism. Conservatives were elated, for what they had been saying for years was now the official foreign policy of the United States. By calling the Soviet Union an evil empire, said Bill Buckley, Reagan had begun the countdown to the fall of communism. Action followed talk. Several weeks after the Evil Empire speech, the U.S. invaded Grenada to oust the Cuban-backed Marxist government, sending Moscow a message that we were serious. The U.S. was providing millions of dollars to the Mujahideen in their battle against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, largely at the behest of Reagan's new CIA chief, William J. Casey. And aid was beginning to flow to the Contras in Nicaragua and to the anti-communists in El Salvador. In March of 1983, Reagan announced plans to build the Strategic Defense Initiative, and in October, much to the chagrin of the Kremlin, Reagan placed cruise and Pershing missiles in Western Europe. Each was a bullet into the heart of Soviet communism, and each one contributed to its fall. There were many other factors that contributed to the collapse of Soviet communism, and we'll never know how all of those factors fit together. But there's no question that without Ronald Reagan, who was practicing what the conservative movement had been preaching for the previous 40 years, the Cold War would have gone on much longer than it did. Its demise changed the shape of the world more than anything else that transpired since the end of World War II, half a century before. The second major structural change, which came about as a result of conservative ideas, reordered economic and tax policies not only in the United States but in the rest of the free world. That change was the introduction of supply-side economics. Traditional demand-side economics, or Keynesianism, argues that the best way to stimulate the economy during an economic downturn is to pump money into it through government spending, which in turn will stimulate demand for goods and services. It was, until the 1980s, the way virtually every democratic country looked at fiscal policy. But in the 1970s, building on the shoulders of Austrian economists and other free marketeers, a number of conservative and libertarian economists began writing and talking about a new, more free market-oriented way of stimulating the economy. Very simply, they believed that economies would thrive if government were to spend less, tax less, and stay out of people's way. Instead of raising taxes and spending the receipts to stimulate the economy, why not cut tax rates, giving an incentive to business, investors, and other taxpayers to invest the money, thereby stimulating business and market activity? Lower tax rates would expand the supply of goods and services, which in turn would make the economy grow. A vibrant economy would make the total tax receipts actually grow, even though individual taxpayers were paying lower rates of tax. Liberals, not surprisingly, did not like the idea at all, largely because it gave more economic power to individuals and less to the state. But after he was elected in 1980, Ronald Reagan, who had filled his economic team with free marketeers and supply-siders, pushed through the largest tax cuts in history, cutting individual marginal tax rates by 25%, eliminating indexing of tax rates, which ended bracket creep, and reducing business taxes across the board. After they took effect, the economy soared. According to Wall Street Journal economist Stephen Moore, as a result of the 1982 Reagan tax cuts, there are today 40 million more jobs and nearly $50 trillion higher net worth for the U.S. economy than there were in 1981. Top marginal personal corporate tax rates, which were at 70% and 48% respectively in 1981, are both at 35% today. But the structural change, the lasting change, is that nobody, not even Nancy Pelosi and Charlie Rangel, will ever propose raising top rates to 70% again. For one thing, they know full well that if they do, they will suffer the same fate as Walter Mondale did when he proposed a tax hike. And more important, even liberals cannot refute the supply-siders' argument that increases in marginal tax rates will affect the economy negatively. To be sure, liberals hate supply-side economics, but it is impossible to even have a discussion about taxes today without making supply-side economics part of the debate. Liberals are happy to raise taxes when they can, but even they understand the consequences and often take the supply-side argument into consideration. A further structural change is the fact that the supply-side economics has extended far beyond the shores of the United States. And in fact, there's a supply-side tax-cutting revolution going on across the globe. Countries of the old Soviet bloc, including Russia, and the Baltic countries, Iceland, Hong Kong, Vietnam, old Europe, France, Spain, and Germany, and even socialist Sweden are part of the supply-side revolution. All have cut marginal tax rates, implemented a flat tax, and cut corporate tax rates as a way of stimulating their economies. There's been an explosion of wealth in the world over the past 20 years. Free markets, free trade, the rule of law, and lower taxes, all things that Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, and other free marketeers argued for beginning in the 1940s, are the driving force that is creating that wealth. The third area that I want to talk to you about today, an area where conservative ideas are now turning into policies, is the role of the federal courts and the selection of federal judges. Under the Constitution, the President is given the power to appoint federal judges, both to the Supreme Court and the appellate and trial courts, subject to advice and consent or confirmation by the Senate. For most of our history, presidents have appointed friends and political allies, most as a way of rewarding political friends. For the most part, the Senate confirmed the president's choice without much opposition. But as the courts began to involve themselves in areas of social and political policy, as they lurched increasingly to the left, and as they rewrote the Constitution, it became clear to conservative court watchers that a new system of picking judges needed to be devised. During this period, conservatives and Republican politicians often railed against the federal courts. The Republican candidates often promised to appoint what they called strict constructionist judges. Richard Nixon was the classic example, who based a great part of his 1968 campaign on the fact that he would reform the courts with judges who would decide cases rather than write new laws. But most of his appointments were simply more of what presidents had always done. Of his four Supreme Court appointees, only one, William Rehnquist, was a conservative. The others, William Powell, Warren Burger, and Harry Blackmun, largely continued on the path established by Earl Warren, William Brennan, and William Moe Douglas, who considered the Constitution a living document which could be construed and expanded as necessary, adding new rights according to whatever the current situation mandated. But again, let's go back to Ronald Reagan, who brought a group of constitutional scholars into his administration, many of them young, former Supreme Court clerks, who understood conservatives' criticism of the federal courts and knew what had to be done about it. Devise a system to determine how a judicial appointee would likely rule on constitutional issues and then appoint federal judges who understood and who would respect the Constitution. In order for conservatives to regain control of the federal courts, in other words, Supreme Court justices would need to stick close to the text and history of the Constitution and not simply construct new rights. With help from the first George Bush, Reagan did just that. He appointed over half of all sitting federal judges, including many outstanding conservative intellectuals who had a firm grasp of constitutional law. In doing so, he reshaped the courts in a way not seen since the founding of the Republic. The result was that politics began to be removed from the courts and the courts began to return to their rightful constitutional role. But there was also a structural change. First, conservatives became a mainstay on the federal courts, and their ideas and theories of the law and constitution became mainstream. It was no longer inconceivable that a conservative intellectual could be confirmed to the Supreme Court. What a change that was from the days of Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas. Second, the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted as the founders conceived it when it was written, what lawyers call originalism, has earned in the years since a respected place in constitutional interpretation in the courts. As former Attorney General Edwin Meese wrote not long ago, originalism, like democracy, is seen by almost everyone, even its opponents, as the only way forward. Even liberal law professor Ronald Dworkin announced recently that we are all originalists now. Well, everybody is not an originalist. Far from it. There are still plenty of proponents of a living constitution, and there are plenty of proponents of the use of the courts to get what cannot be gotten through the democratic process, as was witnessed recently in the gay marriage case here in California, where four unaccountable judges defied the will of 62% of your population. There is now an alternative, originalism, the concept of grounding legal opinions on the bedrock of original understanding. It's one of those conservative ideas which, because it was a good idea, has developed into policy. It is a policy that is intelligent, well thought through, and which can have and is having a tremendous impact on the federal courts and on the country. The days of Warren Court jurisprudence are nearly dead, a battle that conservatives are winning. The courts and therefore the country are far better off because of it. If there were victories in the past, what about today? Where is conservatism today? And I suspect as we get into the question and answer period, you'll probably have a good many questions about that. There's no question that the conservative movement has its share of problems, its share of challenges, and its share of battles that remain to be fought. Politically, at least, in 2008, it's in sorry shape. But everything is not political, and if times seem grim to conservatives, all is not by any means lost. It's in sorry shape politically because politicians don't stick to principle. Conservatives necessarily look to the GOP, to the Republican Party, as their access to power. And it's always been an uncomfortable and difficult marriage, and it probably always will be. Conservatism is the soul of the Republican Party, but the Republican Party has lost its soul. You might say that it's sold its soul for a group of earmarks. The Republican Party needs to return to be the party of fiscal responsibility, the party of personal responsibility, and the party of strong traditional American values. There are still Republicans who adhere to those ideals, but too many elected officials, particularly those in the U.S. Congress, have become nothing but a bunch of sniveling little money grubbers. All they can think of is the next election and how they will curry favor for this or that group by to buy their votes. They will pay the price in November for it as they lose more seats and the Democrats solidify their majorities in both houses of Congress. But all is not politics. Conservatives are in the battle for the long term, and losing an election here or there has never, for the true conservative, been the end of the world. Conservatives are in the battle to change minds, to change attitudes, to influence the culture, and to preserve Western civilization. In that regard, conservatives are in uncommonly good shape and will carry on that battle into generations to come. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Alfred Regnery for his presentation today. He is the publisher of The American Spectator, the author of the new book, Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservatism, for his comments this evening. My name is Bob Saldick. I am a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be conducting the audience question portion of tonight's program. Now, Mr. Regnery, we have a lot of questions, so let's plunge in.
Good.
You ended up your talk with the kind of the state of the play today, and of course we've got a huge flock of questions. You've got to talk about the current president. Was George W. Bush or is George W. Bush a compassionate conservative? Is he a conservative? What will George W. Bush's legacy be reflected upon by conservatives?
Thank you. George Bush is not a conservative. He has certain conservative tendencies. He was elected, or when he was elected, I think he probably didn't really know what a conservative was. He used the term compassionate conservative because I think he wanted basically to follow Ronald Reagan's footsteps, as every other Republican politician does, because he thought it would help him get elected, which I guess it did. But he wanted to qualify that by being compassionate, which meant using the government for purposes that conservatives don't think you should use it for. Frankly, I think he's been a huge disappointment in most regards. He's been a big spender. He's increased the size of the government vastly. He has deteriorated American esteem abroad. He's done some good things, on the other hand. I think he's appointed a good many good judges. His tax cuts were excellent. I think those were certainly supply-side tax cuts that he recognized that. He's stuck to his guns on a good many things. I think the Iraq War, and I think most conservatives think the Iraq War is a disaster. Most conservatives supported him initially out of patriotism, I guess, but as the war went on, they realized that this was not a war that was being fought in Americans' best interests, as conservatives think war should be. So I guess maybe that says as much as I need to about his legacy.
These questions further explore this issue. Where does conservative thought evidence itself today in national politics? It surely does not appear to be part of the Republican Party platform. And a related question, how can the conservatives be in the ascendancy when the Republican Party will probably lose the presidency, even with a candidate who is not a conservative, and will they also suffer a crushing defeat in Congress? What are we looking forward to now in the next few months?
Well, I think it's a Democratic year, and I think the Democrats probably will pick up seats in both houses of Congress. What happens in the presidential race is probably anybody's guess. I think that it could be a landslide for Obama, and it could be a landslide for John McCain, and I don't think anybody has any idea what's going to happen between now and then. In terms of the conservative movement, as I said, conservatives are in this for the long term. Elections are won and lost for all kinds of reasons. And many times it doesn't really have a great deal to do with the philosophy of the candidate or the voters. It's like a good sports team. You can have the best team and the best coach and the best equipment and the best training, and you still lose games. And I think to some extent that's what's happening. In the event that Democrats win, conservatives will go on, and they'll keep fighting their battles. It probably will be pretty good for the movement. It always is. When there's opposition, they will consolidate their forces. They're the intellectual side of it. The ideas will continue on. I'm not challenged by liberal ideas. I don't think liberals really have many ideas that are anything more than redoing the old New Deal. Conservatives still do. There's a vast array of scholars and think tanks and activists, grassroots people across the country who are doing all sorts of things, and they will continue doing that.
Several folks in the audience asked questions related to neocons. Here's one. Fred Barnes describes neocons as big government conservatives. In your book, you quote Bill Buckley speaking highly of neocons. Are you saying in his heart Bill Buckley was a neocon? Where do the neocons fit in today to the conservative movement?
Well, there's a great deal of confusion about neoconservatives. Initially, neoconservatives sort of emerged in the late 60s, early 70s, and at first they were concerned about domestic policy. They were concerned that the Great Society, even back into the 60s, wasn't working, that it was the social policy was doing more harm than good. Many of them were sociologists, and they brought some very interesting arguments to the fore. They really became, in the 70s, more anti-communist. They were, the bulk of them were Democrats. Many of them were intellectuals. Some of them had been communists, but many of them were very staunch anti-communist, good, solid foreign policy people, people like Henry Jackson and Jean Kirkpatrick and a good many others. Those were the old neocons. Now, the neoconservatives, after Reagan was elected, many of them went into the Reagan administration and joined forces with him. Many of them actually became Republicans. In the more recent incarnation of, I suppose, really the third incarnation, if you will, are a group of mostly think tank intellectuals whose primary concern is furthering American policy around the world. They're not concerned about domestic policy. They're not concerned about typical conservative values such as limited government, lower taxes, those things. The Iraq War is pretty much their cause, and they think that we should probably invade Iran next and go from one to the next. To the extent that they think about domestic policy, as Fred Barnes said, they're big government conservatives, and I think any real conservative will tell you there's simply no such thing. You can't be for big government and be a conservative at the same time.
In your book, which I thoroughly enjoyed reading, you state that the groups which came together to found conservatism included libertarians, anti-communists, traditionalists, and later joined by religious conservatives. I think, is that a still that's a fair true. Statement? Right. What about libertarians today? One questioner suggests that is a libertarian the only true conservative today? Another questioner addresses the situation with young conservatives who seem to be more libertarian-oriented than traditionally oriented. Do you see traditional conservatism giving way to a generalized anti-collectivism in the next generation?
Well, you know, it's very hard to really put people into these neat categories because nobody fits. Everybody has a little bit different philosophy, and certainly libertarianism, which basically means, to some people, it means no government at all. It means ultimate freedom or as little government as possible. I mean, I remember I was interviewing Milton Friedman, actually, before I wrote my book, and I mentioned something about the word conservative. He said, no, I'm not a conservative. I'm a libertarian. He believed in legalizing drugs, for example. Other libertarians don't. So, you can't really put people into neat little boxes, I suppose. Libertarians have they certainly make a huge contribution, particularly on economics, which is largely their strong suit. They're largely supply-siders, as I talked about. In terms of young people, again, I think they're all over the place. I think probably in many cases they do tend to be more libertarian than traditional, and as is usual, I guess, with people as they get older, they'll probably become more traditional.
Again, going back to your book, you spend a good bit of time in the book talking about Goldwater and how he so successfully collected money from a huge number of people.
I did.
And that was without the Internet. Was Goldwater the precursor to Obama of today?
You know, I wrote an op-ed piece three or four weeks ago that talked about the comparison between the Obama and the Goldwater campaign. And when I first proposed it, I said, come on, you've got to be crazy. There's no comparison here. But in fact, yes, what Goldwater did was exactly what Obama's doing. When Goldwater ran, he collected contributions from some 3 million people. 4 years before, when Nixon was the Republican candidate, he had 40,000 donors. And until then, Republican donors were largely wealthy people who then called the shots and what happened. And they were, as Goldwater changed that by raising money from all these people in small amounts, basically he introduced the concept that the grassroots, the people across the country, would control the Republican Party instead of those who were giving large sums of money. Obama has a money machine. There's no question about it. And it's largely been done by the Internet, by a group of people in Northern California who understand how the Internet works. They look at him as a startup. I suggest you read a very interesting piece in the current issue of The Atlantic on Obama, and one of them is quoted as saying Obama is a brand. He said that we think of him as a $250 million business. We think of the voters and the donors as customers. Now, the difference with Obama and Goldwater now becomes apparent. Goldwater wasn't a brand. It wasn't Barry Goldwater who was attracting all those people. It was what he stood for. And Goldwater had written, of course, The Conscience of a Conservative, a 120-page book which spelled out his principles in very clear language. 4 million people bought it, read it, and it made a huge difference in the way people thought. And Goldwater always said, it's not about me, it's about the principles that I stand for. In Obama's case, it's all about Obama. I mean, his principles are the same as Hillary Clinton's, the same typical Democratic Party principles that the Democrats run on. And so the principle part of it is missing. And I guess my question is, can he make this last if he is no longer there?
Let's switch to a simple subject, the religion. How important is religion in the conservative movement, and is the conservative movement drawing strength from religious organizations as much as it seemed to be doing in past months, or is that effort slowly changing?
Well, it's been an important factor. It's not crucial. There was a big fight about it at National Review a long time ago when One of their senior editors left because he said it was becoming too Catholic. And Bill Buckley commented that in terms of Christianity, he said, you don't have to be a Christian, you don't have to be Jewish, you don't have to be religious to be a conservative, but you have to respect religion if you were a conservative. And it certainly has played a big part intellectually over the course of its history. In terms of the current situation, there are certainly the evangelical Christians make up a large set of force in the Republican Party. They are what we call cultural conservatives, and their primary issues are family values, abortion, gay rights, things like that. But many of them are also as dedicated to free markets and to other conservative values as the rest of us. There's always a lot of writing going on about to what extent they will turn out in the next election and how important they'll be, and I guess that remains to be seen.
How do you feel about the oft-restated objective of many of in the Republican world of starving the beast, starving the government so that it finally somehow goes away?
It never happens, I guess. That is a theory. That was one of the things that was talked about in the Reagan tax cuts. But in fact, the Reagan tax cuts generated more money overall for the government than they'd been getting before. And they knew that. I mean, they knew that if you cut tax rates, the economy will grow, everybody will be making more money, and they'll pay more taxes. It's just distributed differently among taxpayers. So it's probably a nice theory, but I guess it's only a theory. It'll never happen. The government is like a ratchet. It keeps getting bigger, but you can never move it back. And when you form a government program, I mean, it's virtually impossible to end it. The people that like big government know that. That's really the whole premise of what was going on, and certainly in the Great Society in the 60s, as they were creating all sorts of groups and forces to maintain those government programs and so on. I talk about that considerably in my book. Reducing governments is more of a theory, I guess, than a reality, unfortunately.
Bill Buckley, he comes many questions here for some reason, I guess because of his recent demise, about how you feel about him. Would you give a short assessment, a personal reflection of Bill Buckley is one question. How do you feel how important has he been to the movement and so forth? Bill Buckley.
Sure. Actually, I met Bill Buckley the first time when I was about 8 years old. He was a good friend of my father's, and I saw him many times. I interviewed him over 2 days for this book. He was crucial to the conservative cause. He graduated from Yale, wrote God and Man at Yale, which my father published. The book was a sensation. It opened the door to criticism of higher education. And it launched Bill Buckley, and he never stopped. I mean, he was incredibly prolific. He wrote really brilliant things about everything that you can imagine. He wrote 40 books and countless columns and his debates and his lectures and everything else. He was an icon. I think that probably there's no individual outside of politics that had more influence on conservatism than Bill Buckley, and had he not appeared on the scene, the political, probably really the political landscape today in the United States would look considerably different.
Fascinating. Here's several questions who could ask you to compare William F. Buckley with some of the modern preachers for the Republican world, like Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage. How do you feel about all those people?
Well, they all have their place. I mean, they are not Bill Buckley's. Bill Buckley was a very highly educated man. He was very well spoken. He was a wonderful writer. He had a great mind, and he was also a consummate gentleman. Had a great sense of humor. One of the things he did do was to introduce the idea with his magazine National Review of communicating with conservatives. I mean, that was one of the first magazines that was founded, and he went around the country speaking and writing because he wanted to further his views by the written word and by the spoken word. So to the extent that that the four that you mentioned do that, I guess that's probably maybe where the similarity ends. You know, I don't want to go through one after the other. I think that particularly take the case of Rush Limbaugh. He has had a huge impact. I mean, the guy has an audience of 15 million people every day or every week, whatever it is. He can suggest that things be done, and they get done. I think there's something like 3,000 conservative talk show hosts. Actually, talk radio is a huge resource to conservatives because it is one of the ways they have of getting their message out to the country, and they do, and they're In my book, I have some pretty good examples of some of the things that talk radio has done that has accomplished really quite amazing feats.
Looking at the leaders of the American conservative movement, the questioner asks, who do you see as the most likely future leaders of American conservatism today?
Well, that's a tough question. That's one place where the conservative movement really has a problem, and that is that it doesn't have certainly an individual leader. I mean, they had at one time back in the very early days, Robert Taft of Ohio was sort of viewed as their leader. Goldwater came along. Reagan came along. Newt Gingrich, I guess, did for a while. But as the movement got bigger, as politics got more complicated, as more things were happening, there wasn't any one person who filled that role, and there still isn't. There are a good many very bright and able conservatives in various offices around the country and doing other things that are not political. I can't tell you who the leader would be, but then, as I stated before we started, a year ago you never would have thought that Obama and McCain would be the nominees, so people come out of the woodwork sometimes pretty quickly, and we don't know who they might be.
You talked about George W. Bush when we started this, and a questioner asks about the new book by Scott McClellan and the impact that seems to be having on the integrity of the administration. Would you comment on that?
Well, there are books like that that come along all the time. McClellan wrote this book. I think from what I understand it, he sort of got stronger and stronger as he wrote it in opposition to the Bush administration. He had been its spokesman for a long time. My guess is it's sort of a flash in the pan. Having published a good many books, some of them that were those kinds of things, they sell for 4 to 6 weeks, and then pretty soon after that they're forgotten. And, you know, what more detrimental can be said about George Bush? I mean, it's all been said over and over and over again, and somebody comes along and says bad things about him, so what?
I wonder if he feels that way. Back to the media. To what extent, an audience member asks, to what extent is there a liberal bias in mainstream media? Are there not a significant number of conservative outlets like the American Spectator to combat liberals?
It's much less than it used to be because conservatives now do own part of the media. The big media, that is, the principal newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, papers like that, are pretty much predominantly liberal. The networks are pretty much dominated by liberals, but then there's cable television and there's talk radio and there's the blogs and all those other things. So certainly no conservative can complain that he can't get conservative news. That simply doesn't happen. The mainstream media, as it's called, the drive-by media, as Rush Limbaugh calls it, is pretty much predominantly liberal, though.
There's another book that's just come out recently called The Family. Are you familiar with that organization and how important, what are they and how important are they? Are they an important part of conservatism?
I don't know what that book is.
Okay, pass on that. Several questioners talk about conservative objection to things that have been woven into the fabric of the society today. Here's a typical question. Would a true conservative take away a woman's right to have an abortion if she chose to do so? Another question was about Brown v. Board of Education, which was certainly viewed as not a good thing when it happened, I think, by the conservative movement, I believe. You may correct me on that.
That's true. Actually, in both cases, I would go back to the Constitution and to the way the courts handled those cases. The Brown case, I actually spend quite a bit of time in my book on Brown versus Board of Education. It's a fascinating case, the way it happened. And when it came down, desegregated the schools, conservatives, there were probably some that were upset about the fact that it desegregated the schools, but much more conservatives were upset that the court, in fact, had taken this on and had decided the case at all, because they said that the court had no jurisdiction whatsoever to decide a case that told the states how they were to run their schools. That was simply not in the purview of the Constitution. Similarly, with Roe versus Wade, I think that for the most part, the conservative position now is that, and it has been right along, that it's a situation where Roe versus Wade should be reversed because of the fact that it's an unconstitutional case. There's no justification in the case for under the Constitution for the right to abortions. So that should be given back to the states. It should be decided by the state legislatures where they can actually read what the do it through the democratic process, read what people want, and do it that way.
A couple of questions about your publications. It says, this city has been described as so blue it's indigo. Do you have a large readership here?
I'd never heard that term before, but...
Me neither. Is the American Spectator widely distributed around here?
Well, it's like any opinion magazine, it doesn't have a huge circulation. I don't really know what the... I think probably the largest part of our circulation is on the East Coast and the West Coast. And I really don't know what it is in San Francisco. I hope it's, if it's not big now, I hope it gets bigger. You should all subscribe. Spectator.org.
I need a commercial break here. Questioner says, I read online that your family has a history of promoting sympathy and empathy towards war-torn, peaceful Germans. How or do you and your publications perpetuate that understanding of today's immigrants and refugees from war-torn areas? Is that something you all have been looking at?
No, we really haven't. We haven't really, in the magazine, we haven't taken any position on immigration. I don't think it's really a conservative liberal issue. It's an extremely difficult issue, and I mean, any group of people you get into a room to talk about, there are going to be as many opinions as there are people. So we haven't really taken a position about that, so that's about all I can say.
Long-term, What kind of predictions would you leave the audience with respect to the Commonwealth, to the conservative movement going forward in the next 30 years?
Well, of course, it's always hard to answer that. I think that this country is right of center, generally speaking. People that look at these things, pollsters, and who ask people questions will say that if you drew a line down the middle philosophically in this country, more or less 54-55% would be to the right, and 43, 44, 45, 46 would be to the left in some way. A lot of people think that liberals know that, and Democrats realize that, which is why they campaign the way they did, basically obscuring their point of view. If that's true, and I don't know if it is or not, and given the fact that the conservative movement has an enormous resource, in terms of its people, its ideas, its donors, its grassroots, its think tanks, all those other things, I think it speaks pretty well for it. As Lord Keynes said, the world revolves around ideas. It's not vested interests that that change things. It's ideas. And the ideas I talked about, the idea of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, of American values, of things that really most of us believe down to our core, don't change. And you can have little wavers here and there and different things, but over the long term, I think Americans want those same kind of traditional things that we've always had. Those are things that conservatives talk about in one way or another. And again, the conservative movement is a very broad-based, enterprise with people that come from every different direction and so on, but you put it all together, they do have a great many good ideas. They keep generating new ones, and some of them are good, some of them are bad, but much more than the other side does. So from that perspective, I guess I can be quite optimistic.
You're listening to or watching the radio or television program from the Commonwealth Club of California here in San Francisco. Speaking tonight is Alfred Regnery, publisher of The American Spectator and author of an important new book, Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservatism. So, a related question, in a post-George W. world, what do you envision as the path back to a restored national faith and the more deeply rooted tenets and values of conservatism? How do we get back to what you are so proud of in the Reagan years?
Well, I'm not sure that we'll ever get back to that. I mentioned in my book that the Reagan administration was probably the high point of political conservatism anyway. You had somebody who had these conservative ideas really into his bones, who hadn't changed for years, who was a marvelous politician and a marvelous communicator, and also a very good manager. And as we look back on his administration, I think everybody agrees that it was, he looks much better now than it even did when he finished. You don't get people in politics like that very often, and I think the American political system probably is becoming such that most people that have those kinds of principles and ideas don't want anything to do with politics. I mean, you look at what's going on, what you have to go through to get elected these days, it's hard to conceive of any sane person wanting to do that. So that doesn't speak very well for it. But again, I guess in respond the way I did in the previous question, that if it's ideas that really are what have more impact than anything else, I subscribe to the ideas and that I think most Americans do as well in one way or another, and I think that those will continue to have impact and keep the country going on sort of the same track.
I guess that means you're not going to run for public office. I guess that means you're not going to run for public office.
I don't think so.
You mentioned some other countries and some ways in which they are behaving according to the principles of conservatism. Are there any other countries that really are effective implementers of the conservative philosophies?
There are a good many of the former East Bloc countries, the Baltic countries for one, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, are at least from an economic standpoint, are amazingly free market. Nobody has a constitution like we do, and that is something that is really the foundation of everything American. And without that kind of a constitution, they can probably never have the same system. Europe is really much further to the left than we are, with the exception of some of the tax things I talked about. But the EU is so highly regulated, and really they're for all intents and purposes, if not socialist, they're complete welfare states. That there's really no comparison there. Otherwise, I guess I'm not really sure I don't think there's anybody that holds a candle to the United States in terms of our policies.
And the ways in which they are modeling conservative behavior were largely fiscal, as I understand it. In other words, flat tax and things
right.
of that sort. Mm-hmm. Are there any modeling conservative objectives with respect to small government and limited social policies to Social Security and the privatizing all the things like that?
Actually, a good many countries have privatized Social Security, one of which, believe it or not, is China. And there are a good many others who picked up on the idea that Social Security could be privatized and people could actually be enabled to have their own investment accounts. I don't know how those are working. They're all fairly recent. And there are other individual things like that I guess are being done here and there.
China privatized it by canceling their health insurance program. Isn't that the way they did it?
No, I think they actually, I don't know exactly to what extent they did that, but I don't know a great deal about it, just the fact that they are alleged to have privatized Social Security.
Here's a question about President Reagan, which is interesting. Do you consider the role of Islamic Revolution in Iran helpful to Reagan when he came in to government? As you recall, there was under table discussions going between the Republican Party and the clerics in Iran. Was Reagan in communication with Iranian leadership in those years?
I don't know.
But isn't it pretty well accepted?
I mean, certainly Iran-Contra, if that's what you're talking about, was a big issue in 1986 or 7, I guess. Certain members of his administration were trading basically arms for terrorists, or they were talking about it. I can't remember all the details. And as I do recall, there was a big question whether or not Reagan knew about it, and I don't think that question was ever answered.
Was the release of the hostages, wasn't that part of the whole?
Well, that was in 1980 or 81. That was when he was inaugurated. That was long before that.
Okay.
Two different issues.
Okay. I probably have them mixed up. Following a question from the audience, following the Commonwealth Club's founding statement of we only propose to find truth and turn it loose in the world, they're asking a question about a specific book. Do you believe that you have published, that all that you have published, such as Gary Aldrich's book claiming Hillary Clinton hung crack pipes from the White House Christmas trees, is valid? Is that I don't know. That's what it says.
Well, I'm not sure what the question was. I did publish a book by Gary Aldrich, a FBI agent, which was called Unlimited Access, about the Clinton administration, that had a lot of allegations in it about the Clintons, which were actually considered quite outrageous when they were published. And within 3 or 4 years, everybody said, yeah, I guess that's probably true. So we were quite sure that he was telling the truth when we published it.
One of the issues today is that we're so reluctant in this war to ask for much citizen involvement in the war, other than the poor chaps who are over there fighting it. So the question, and especially with respect to financing it through deficit spending, so the question is from the audience, would a true conservative use deficit spending to finance the war in Iraq, assuming that he was persuaded it was a good thing to do in the first place? Or would they go after taxation, I guess?
I guess that question would take a while to answer it, and there are a lot of facets to it. I mean, as I say, conservatives don't really like the Iraq war. Most conservatives in the House are probably voting to fund it because the troops are there and we feel we need to support them as long as they're there. They don't like the fact that they're there. They wish they weren't, but since they are, they fund them. Whether it's deficit financing or taxation basically becomes a political question, I guess. I mean, no politician likes to say that he's raising taxes because it's bad politics. It's easier to pawn it off on the next generation, which is something that politicians have been doing from day one. So I guess I can't answer for all of them.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. So from the audience, a quotation. The man who is not a socialist at 20 has no heart, but if he is still a socialist at 40, he has no head. The question is, did you have a heart at 20?
I hope so. I hope I still do. I've always been a conservative, though. I don't think that says that you have to be a socialist to have a heart, does it?
I don't think so.
That would not be the logic that it used.
Thank you. Our thanks to Alfred Regnery, publisher of The American Spectator and the author of the new book, Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservatism. We thank our audiences here and on the radio and in television. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you very much.